Okay, so in the remaining hour of my talk, I will discuss how we understand some aspects of ARPES from the perspective of these formulae that I've shown you. As everybody knows, the ARPES intensity consists of a spectral function multiplied by a Fermi function. And there is a matrix element which is assumed to be Beakley K dependent, if at all. So this is what we measure, this is what we can calculate, and that's what we want to compare. And A, of course, is this microscopic object, the spectral function, which tells you when I create a hole, how much does the hole disperse in energy depending upon the matrix elements. And this is given in terms, of course, of the Green's function. The imaginary part of the Green's function gives us the A, K of omega. And in the Fermi liquid, as we all know, this has a Lorentzian form where gamma is roughly omega squared plus T squared. And E of K is the quasi-particle energy. So when the photoemission game started in the year 1990, I was at Bell Labs when this first set of experiments was shown, and it created a real shock in the audience. I think people just didn't know what was going on. Maybe Benoit was in the audience too at that point. Maybe Antoine was there as well.
No, I've seen these curves first when they were sent to field by fax.
I see. Oh, you saw it in Princeton before it was shown in Bell Labs. And you know, people said, this is crazy. This is something absolutely unbelievable. What are you seeing here, you know? And in a way, it was an embarrassment that the first good experiment on a Fermi liquid ARPES was done after this. So this is basically, angle resolved is basically the new thing. So this was a new way of looking at photoemission, which, you know, created lots of puzzles followed by simple examples. So this is a counterexample to all this. This is what you expect from a good Fermi liquid. So titanium ditelluride has very good Fermi liquid behavior. Resistivity goes like T squared. And you see that these ARPES line shapes look pretty much Lorentzian. And of course, we've come a long way from here. And in fact, I have some real experts in ARPES in the audience today. They will probably kill me for showing such an old, such a wrong, such a bad sample. But cleaner samples have brought the line widths down to much more sensible kind of results. And then I'll also say that laser-excited ARPES has turned out to be a real boon. It gives us really sharp lines, much sharper than any of these things. They're actually even sharper than these in some cases. But they provide us with other kinds of puzzles that I want to talk about. So we have refined experiments and we have refined questions. So before getting into all that, I want to talk for a few minutes about a very lovely paper by Phil Anderson himself. So this is a paper which he used together with Phil Casey, used some old ideas which have been lying around from the X-ray singularity problem. And in fact, their origin is very much in France. Nozier de Dominici's had this remarkable exact solution of the X-ray edge problem. And Doniak Sunjek gave a, you know, nice packaging of that later. So this really goes back to Nozier and Dominici's work. And Phil found a way of reviving this so-called dead object and giving it new life and claiming to explain the line shapes in high TC. So what Phil did is in a paper together with Jake Koralek and Dan Dessau. So this is the first experiment on laser ARPES. So it's not a historic paper because it's got historic first results on laser ARPES, and also historic because very anachronistically, Phil Anderson went back in time to some 40 years ago in a time machine and sort of brought back gold from there. So what Phil's argument is something very simple. He said, it's like a 1D problem and you have X minus VFT is like a Fermi liquid. And you multiply the Fermi liquid by a factor which comes from X-ray edge singularity. So the rationale for this particular power law dependence of the multiplying factor is very deep. It's a mysterious paper of Phil's. And he has written several explanations. And I can guarantee you that every explanation is more mysterious than the earlier explanation. So it's really a riddle wrapped in an enigma, as they say. And I spent a fair amount of time trying to understand this. I really don't know where he got it from. But he's got an expression where there is a non-universal power law with an exponent that depends upon the density of particles. So this I understand. If I really do the calculation, this is what comes out. But why these should be combined in a particular way is sort of mysterious. And you have to give hats off to him. And he produced a function which is remarkable. It's very simple in a way. And it's like, so if you dig into this, so this sine of something, something omega, this object is not Fermi-liquid-like. It's in fact far from a Fermi-liquid. In fact, you'll see that this gamma, which is the lifetime of this object, is proportional to temperature, not T squared. And at T equal to zero, this is actually zero. So you have a non-Fermi liquid at all densities. And what is interesting is, at finite temperatures, this looks a lot like ECFL. Very, very similar features are contained in this, as I will show you in a minute, because it has the right asymmetry built into it. So here, this omega term out here in the argument of the sine, this distinguishes between particles and holes and gives you very asymmetric results. So indeed, this was a comparison between the experiments and the theory and at different temperatures. And you know, this was basically a remarkably beautiful fit. And if you didn't have anything else in the market, you would say, well, this is the solution. This has got to be the solution of the problem. So it turns out that ECFL does better. We, in fact, get even better fits than this. And it turns out that this theory cannot explain synchrotron data. Basically, it's geared to understanding only the laser ARPs. So we can do more universal and more better fits, as I will show you in a minute. But I want to sort of throw this at you, in some sense, to stimulate you to think about the possibility of amazing calculations. You know, it's such a simple calculation, and it has so much rich physics, which I don't think even Phil really appreciated the asymmetry. When I told him about it, he said, oh, this is interesting. But of course, he's unhappy with the fact that ECFL at the lowest frequencies is a Fermi liquid, whereas his theory is ultimately non-Fermi liquid in a much more harsh way. So what I want to show you is the first fit that we had with Gay Hong. And as I said, I think we had the beginner's luck to some extent working with us. So we took this simplified ECFL that I showed you in the beginning. It's a three-parameter fit where you have basically omega 0 and omega 0 as the only two parameters. And eta is this elastic scattering term. And C is some known number, like two-thirds or something. And delta is obtained from some sum rule. So this is a global fit, because omega is no longer just small omega. It runs over the entire Brillouin zone, over all frequencies. So this is a global fit at all frequencies. And this satisfies various sum rules. And we asked, how does this fit the experimental data? And we found a lot of interesting results, as I will show you in a minute. So what you do is take the band structure and pick out some 10 values of the k near the Fermi surface. Here is the Fermi momentum, and you pick some 5 values below and 5 above. And ask yourself, what do the spectra look like in experiment, and how do they compare with this functional form, where these three parameters are fixed once and for all. You make one global choice, that's it. You don't play with it for different k's. You sort of go with what you have. And this is basically what you find. So these are these 10 values of k, k1, k2, k3, all the way to k10. You see k10 is already so weird, it has no peak at all. And yet, you know, this functional form captures most of it. And at the Fermi surface, which is, I think, the fifth one, you see that you have a peak which is slightly displaced from zero. The peak is pulled into the left. Antoine, note, this is what we were talking about earlier today. You see that you have a fairly sharp peak, and then you have an asymmetric curve, which basically has much more weight for occupied state than for unoccupied state. So this is the characteristic feature that we already saw in the Olson data right in the beginning. And I should say that this experimental data is taken from, I mean, Guion, who's my experimental colleague at Santa Cruz, he had his own data, but this really was a comparison with existing data from Campuzano's group on BISCO. And this required us to tune this parameter eta at about 0.12 EV. So this was one choice made at one particular K value, and then you stick to it everywhere else. And the other parameters, omega 0 and omega 0, you're going to use this in laser ARPES and also in all kinds of other situations. The only thing you will allow yourself to change is eta, this elastic scattering parameter, which can be different between synchrotron data and laser ARPES data. And even within synchrotron data, depending upon the energy of the incident photon, eta has to be adjusted. The physics behind that is that when the incoming photon comes in and knocks out an electron from the many-body system, this exiting photoelectron has to traverse the entire solid to get out. So one has to ask the question, what is the mean free path of this exiting photoelectron through this gelium in which not just the interesting band but all the rest is buried? And the gelium is a very well-known and a very famous problem, well-studied in the old days. And Hedin has a very nice paper written in the 90s where he showed that the mean free path of the exiting electron is very short at about 10 electron volts or 15 electron volts of the synchrotron data. And it really becomes long as you go to lower energy. So laser ARPES, which is at about 6 electron volts, the mean free path is very, very long. So what this means is that if you're exciting photo emission through a low energy source, you are sampling the bulk. Whereas if you are exciting it through synchrotron, there's a possibility that only the electrons from the top surface, top few surfaces are coming out. So more surface sensitive. In which case, you expect to find a greater elastic scattering. So the value of eta that we see from synchrotron is expected to be considerably larger than the value of eta for laser ARPES. And that's exactly what we find in the FITS too. So the next one is, now this is the laser ARPES data. This is the first in the historic laser ARPES data that I mentioned from Jake Goralek and company. And you see that actually our same old FIT, which fit the synchrotron data, also fits this with a slightly different value of eta. In fact, a much lower value of eta. It's about 32 millivolts. So you see the FITs here are as good as the K.C. Anderson FITs. In fact, they're considerably better if you look at them closely. And they also have this asymmetry. So just by going to lasers, we haven't gotten rid of this fundamental asymmetry between holes and particles. You still have this. And I would argue a little later that even this shape here has some hidden asymmetry which you can reveal by looking at the data in a particular way. Yeah. It's in this case, it's not there, you know.
Why?
This FIT doesn't have it. Basically, it's killed by the rapidly decaying gamma. So there's a gamma over gamma squared, and at high frequency, that kills it for these parameters.
In some of your line shapes that you show, this linear in omega term is very prominent.
Yeah.
So some
and they're all coming out from exactly the same functional form. So let me put it the following way. We have one set of global parameters which we use for LSCO as well as BISCO. And LSCO, you'll see that for the values of the energies and stuff, you do see a rising term. Okay? But it kind of rolls off much more rapidly. So in other words, the best way to put it is the following. The devil is in the detail. I mean, we are doing a totally simple FIT to a very simple function. And it indeed has precisely the features that I'm showing you. Okay? And it's the same function, believe me, exactly the same function, but the same parameters. Eta is the only thing which changes, and otherwise it's exactly the same.
Another way to ask the same question is to say that
No, it's not exactly one. It's playing a more subtle role. What I'm saying is the comparison factor plays a very glaring role in certain situations. For example, look at this synchrotron data. Let's see here. Now look at this data compared to this data here, right? Compare this with this. So what's the difference between this and this? The only thing which has changed is the value of E of k. And I'm saying that already this decays much more rapidly than this does. That's because of so it's really not so simple.
It's a trade-off between gamma
Yeah.
and delta.
Gamma and delta. And also this H is not so innocuous after all. H, which is what do you call it, the Hilbert transform of gamma, it also plays, it's not completely innocuous, it does play some role there too. And gamma has an eta sitting in it, so that also has
I think I'm trying to say is that if there is no effect from the delta and the multiplying factor there, the line shape which is here is right of the Mitchell equation. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, let's come back to this point. This is an interesting point, and let's discuss this threadbare in a few minutes. Let's see the full data actually, then we'll talk about this. So here is what happens with laser ARPs with the same parameters. And here you see that the role of eta is important. With eta, you basically recover the line shape for the synchrotron ARPs. Whereas if you don't have an eta and basically you do somewhat, I think it's a bit unfair on my part to call this CADS. CADS is indeed this, but I think even ECFL without the eta would do something roughly like that. So I would say that eta depends upon the initial energy of the photon, and between synchrotron and laser, the only thing which is changing is the value of eta. And larger eta for surface-sensitive probes, such as the high-energy synchrotron ARPs, whereas a smaller eta is required for laser ARPs. Let me show you what happens with the same set of parameters, exactly the same set of parameters. When you apply that to the case of LSCO. And here you see on this energy scale, we have a rising term which looks like this. Okay? And actually, if you tweak this little omega zero parameter, you even recover this exact. You can even fit this better if you want. If you want to use different parameters for LSCO than from BSCO, if you tweak this guy a little bit, you can even fit this better. But I would say, why does the smoking gun show up in certain cases and not in the others? This is the question you want to ask, and I think we need to talk about that a little later. But I would say here, this is indeed precisely a consequence of this minus omega factor. This is really doing this rising term here. Why it is not so effective in the other cases is a little more subtle, and let me postpone that.
But it's not the same set of parameters that is.
It is. That gives this. We chose that to be the same. Of course, you could do an entirely new set of fits for LSCO, but it turned out the data for LSCO was much more sparse. So we had one or two really clean data points, and these experimentalists did not really give us the raw data. We had to basically scan it from the FISDEV letters and stuff like that. It's a painful job to do. So at some point you run out of patience too. But with LSCO, we did a much less thorough job of fitting all the existing data because A, it was sparse, B, less freely available. And I want to say that this rising part, which is this omega here, this is a comment that Antoine made a few hours ago to me. He said, actually, all these things must connect up. In some sense, if you look at this spectral function on a bigger energy scale, let's say between 0 and 1.5 eV, this is much smaller scale here, right? So on this scale, you see that you have a fairly sharp and a dispersive quasi-particle piece, which is followed by a bump here. This bump is from the so-called lower Hubbert band, is what some people call it. I really don't know what to call it. I think it's got to be there for unitarity reasons. To fulfill all the sum rules, you need the weight to go somewhere. It has to go someplace. And it can be calculated. And DMFT calculates it. I calculate it in some other way. So this is my calculation. So you see these guys connect up. So this omega must connect up with this fact that it goes over here and rolls back. And indeed, the important thing to note is that these spectral functions are integrated to one, or to whatever they should. Each spectral function must integrate to number like 1 minus n by 2 if you're doing this TJ model. And that's what they do. So depleting the spectral weight cannot be done arbitrarily. I mean, quantum mechanics forces you to have some rule satisfaction somewhere else. These guys have to go somewhere. So there are big, broad bumps which don't correspond to propagating particles. These are some broad objects. These are like the sloppy spin waves in iron, if you wish. These are some horrible objects. And to connect these two, you have a curve which has to rise somewhere. So basically, this rise here is a part of that action, you know? So in a way, this is not the sole actor. This omega term multiplying A is not the sole actor. If A were a simple Lorentzian with a line width which is independent of omega, this guy would really dominate much more. But in reality, what happens is that the Fermi liquid line function is itself very complex. It itself has line width, which is a function of omega. So you know it's got this Gaussian thing which I drew. So when you combine these properly, this actually leads to a rise followed by a peak followed by a fall. So in a sense, it's an oversimplification to expect this guy to dominate everything. It does play a major role, but once you know who the other actors are and what role the other actors are playing, you can devise means for filtering out the other things and looking at this omega term in isolation. If you really want to isolate this, it's possible. And that's going to be the last part of my talk, actually. Yeah.
The other thought was if you enlarge the range of frequency of an non-frequency, you would see the
lower band? Yeah. In the previous band, absolutely. Here and everywhere, this picture does show that, yeah. So indeed, so that's a very important perspective to keep in mind. Most of the photo emission is really done in this small region here, you know? And very rarely do people bother to look at deep interior. People can do it, I'm sure Veronica will give you a picture of people who've done these measurements. But they're rare, and usually people are doing it for some very specific reasons. Because, you know, in a way, it's messed up because also other bands to worry about and stuff like that. It's a theorist who has a luxury to say, how about unitarity? How about sum rules? You know, we can ask, do things really add up to one? And we can ask these hard questions, and with refined tools, we can get the correct answer. We can actually fulfill things and see how they work. So this is a simple modification of this spectral function to see if we can understand both MDCs and EDCs. So here is an example of the EDC fits that I showed you a minute ago. This is a paper by Kazue Matsuyama, who's a graduate student at Santa Cruz, and Gehong Guion. This is also in Physics of Letters by now. So this is BISCO. You see that within this ECFL formalism, you can fit the EDC. And the question is, what about the MDCs? So here, for BISCO, this guy follows this. This is for LSCO, actually. So let's actually go from here to here. The MDCs here look much more symmetric. So this is the spectral function when you vary the momentum, okay? And you see that with one more parameter in this theory, you can actually have a very symmetric MDC and a very asymmetric EDC. So these two can live together, and they're distinguished by certain coefficients. And this comparison factor, if this K dependence is not there, then you get a symmetric thing. And if you have a K dependence of the sort we had in the first paper, you actually get this fit. And for LSCO, you find that, again, EDCs look asymmetric. The MDCs also look more symmetric. But perhaps if you stare at these hard enough, you distinguish between these two. I think these are somewhat different style. These have a little more asymmetry even in the MDCs. So these are not universal curves. And in fact, today I saw from Veronica her data on sodium misfit cobaltates. they look somewhat more like this. They're not very symmetric, and they have some interesting complexity, which these formulae, I think, can easily capture. So this was basically a phenomenological extension of what we did. These guys took one more parameter, and they found that everything works. So here I want to point out the beginning of a slightly different story. This is the story of low energy kinks. Low energy kinks is a feature which I knew nothing about. It's very interesting. The story is I did this calculation and I gave my PRL to my experimental colleague, and he said, well, do you realize that this theory also has the low energy kink? And I think he fully expected me to say, jump for joy and say, oh, wow, and so on. But my question to him was, what the hell is a low energy kink? So he was very disappointed with my knowledge of ARPES. So I really owe him a lot for teaching me a lot of these features. So I want to say that the high energy kink is visible in the with the comparison factor and without it. You can see it in both of these things. So without the comparison factor, all you do is look at the spectral function of the auxiliary Fermi liquid, and you see that there is a piece here in the E versus K. I mean, this is stretched in energy here. This is between 0 and minus 2 eV. And you know, in a very small energy range, this is the kind of dispersive quasi particles that we look at in photo emission. And this is the lower Hubbard band, the fact state that we saw a few minutes ago. And these are indeed separated by a big gap, which is called the waterfall. And these, both of these kinks, this high energy kink is present in both of these theories. Now, if I look at the low energy data, so here the omega range is between 0 and minus 0.1 eV. So it's in this little blob here, which has been expanded out, okay? So here you see that the intensity in the data has interesting departure from linearity. It basically goes, it curves down, you see? And by the way, these are taken from MDC fits, and you could do similar things with EDC. And in a minute, I'll talk about the distinction more carefully. But you see that there is this kink, and ECFL indeed already, the simplified ECFL model that I showed you, has already got this feature, which I knew nothing about. I had no idea what's happening here. And today, with hindsight, I understand much better, and I'll explain to you why this change in slope happens and what are the various features, factors which govern this feature. I just want to say that the auxiliary Fermi liquid tells you that you don't see this little kink, low energy kink here. This dashed line is what you get from just the Fermi liquid part of it. So in a way here, this comparison factor is making a big difference. So let me explain some of the origin of these things. They're actually ultimately very simple things once you begin to look at the right formula. And some of this is contained in this recent paper. And this really is an elaboration of the spectral function that we already had with Antoine in our comparison with the MFT paper. So here, I'm going to begin with the spectral function summarized for you one more time, because I'm sure you've forgotten what it looks like. So here is k times vf times a velocity factor. So vf is a dimensionless velocity factor, which governs what happens in this Fermi liquid part. And this comparison function has this delta 0 as this energy scale, which comes in with omega. And the k dependence comes in with one more velocity factor, which is a dimensionless number. And gamma 0 here is the Fermi liquid line width, which I have set at 0 frequency. If you want to do a more defined theory, you could certainly put in an omega squared here along with kt squared. But I'm going to argue that for first measure, you can just forget the omega squared. So this is some width of the Fermi liquid. And that's it. So the parameters are eta, omega phi, the two velocities. Now, I'm going to require a modified momentum variable. I take this momentum, multiply by this factor, and add a delta 0. Because once I do this, and r is a ratio of these two velocity factors, v0 and v5. So a bit of an investment on your part. Give me your patience for 2 minutes to learn about these parameters, and you'll see why I'm bothering you with these. They play a role very soon. So here, with this Q parameter defined, so I can take this simple spectral function and I can maximize it in two ways. I can keep k fixed and maximize with respect to omega, and that will give me the so-called E star, the EDC spectrum, which can be calculated quite trivially. I mean, this is really a very simple calculation. And I could do the other way. I could keep omega fixed and scan k. The point here is that the Lorentzian no longer dictates all the terms. Basically, you have to worry about what Mr. Mu is saying. Mu is a function, a linear function of omega and k, which is skewing all of these things, you know, in a very characteristic way with these coefficients. And when you combine them, you get two different dispersion relations. E star of k is the dispersion from EDC, and E of k is from MDC. And both of these guys at zero temperature will turn out to be just k times Vf. And the reason they are different from each other is because of two factors. There is this r here, a ratio of these two velocities, a dimensionless number, and gamma zero, which is this scattering rate. So basically the temperature will appear here into this dispersion relation. So what do these guys look like? Well, these are the peak energies found by maximizing A. And I should say that the MDC is a somewhat fragile object. To find the maximum requires certain constraints on the parameters, which are not always fulfilled. The EDC peak is much more robust. You can always find an EDC peak. And asymptotically, when k becomes very large compared to delta 0, so delta 0 is this characteristic asymmetry scale, like 50 milli electron volts. And when kVf is much bigger than this, you can throw this guy away and q is essentially k. So you see you have a combination of a Dirac and a massive Dirac, a massless and a massive Dirac term. So basically the value, so this the two slopes to the left of q of 0 and to the right of q equal to 0 will not be the same, because you're taking the absolute value of the square of momentum. So basically the two velocities will add in one case, subtract in the other. So you get this funny sine k kind of a term in the asymptotic expression for this. So this is the reason why you begin to see kinks in the dispersion. And these are arising because the caparison factor is playing a role. It's basically determining the location of the peaks in the spectrum. Yeah.
Just one question. Yeah. If we take the t goes to 0 limit,
yeah,
and look at very, very low omega,
yeah,
right, we should find k times vf times v5. Right?
That's what we do.
Not k times vf.
K times vf
times
v5. V5, yes.
Okay, because vf is the bare
formula. You're absolutely right. We should find k times vf times v5. This guy,
we do.
We checked that a few days ago. It's clear from the equation that, in fact, you need to verify that. So, in other words, these formulas are simple and they satisfy several sanity checks. I mean, you have to do lots of sanity checks to make sure that these are reaching the right asymptotic limits of various types. Zero temperature, clean system is indeed something where we know that the dispersion has to be this, and it is indeed that. So I would say that the location of the kinks is basically whenever this q vanishes. Because when q vanishes, that's determining, you know, the crossover from one behavior to the other. So the kink would have a momentum determined by a ratio of delta 0 to v phi. Okay? And if you want to see the kink in ARPES, standard photo emission experiments, kVf has to be negative because it has to be in the occupied state. So that requires r to be bigger than 1. Okay? And only when r is bigger than 1 would this kVf be negative, and you would see that in the occupied states. So this is what the curves look like. So this is E star. You see it has at zero temperature, when you kill everything related to temperature and eta and stuff, you have one straight line with another straight line. And this kink is located at some value which is exactly coincident with this. And the MDC, you have also a kink. It's much more fragile, as I said. And you can say a lot of things, but you need the parameters to be right to find a kink. So the kink is indeed present in both of these guys. In terms of the momentum, they are both located at the same place because the kink location is determined by this condition. But the kink energy, the energy at which this object is located, can also be found from this very simple expression. And you find that in MDC and in EDC, they have slightly different expressions. So this guy here is both are roughly given by delta zero, and this gamma naught enters in some very specific way here. So this low energy kink arises from, you know, this mu factor, from this capacitance factor, and its energy scale roughly reads off the asymmetry scale delta zero. And its dependence on the density, the temperature, and eta are all contained in this really rather simple formulae. You know? So once you understand that the Lorentzian is not the whole story, it's this sort of enlarged Lorentzian which you have to worry about, everything else is essentially trivial algebra and has interesting consequences. Okay, so and these are seen experimentally, so I think it's very exciting to track these down, and a lot of people in the community have been speculating that the kinks cannot be understood within an electronic mechanism. They require the proof positive of phonons being involved is the claim from some people, and I think it's that's certainly not right the way you put it. I mean, phonons can lead to kinks, good, but I think electronic correlations do lead inevitably to kinks. And we know everything about how they depend upon temperature, density, and stuff like that. So we have a simple formula to test out and really nail the kink problem, the low energy kink problem. This is what I'm hoping that we'll be able to do in the next couple of months that I'm in Paris with various friends. Then I want to say in a few minutes some comments about asymmetry. I've talked about the asymmetry in the self-energy, and we've seen that the spectral functions also look asymmetric. But to raise this to a quantitative level, you have to ask yourself, how do I measure asymmetry? How do I quantify it? And I want to show you a couple of ideas about how to do this. And the main message in all both these techniques that I'm going to talk about is that focusing on big line shapes with intensities is really not the right thing. What you have to do is get a perspective on the inverse of the intensities. This is a bit crazy, but indeed it is true. And in my first PRL on the subject, I had already talked about this. I said, look, the line shapes look sort of, you know, fairly sharp if you take away etas and stuff like that. And this is what laser artifacts would look like. But if I invert these guys, you begin to see that you have a sort of strong asymmetry between left and right of the minimum. So in a way, the spectral function is dominated by the peaks. And to see the asymmetry, you have to look at the proximity of the peaks. And indeed, I found that later, nothing is new under the sun, and earlier masters have walked the path before. And this is a beautiful paper by Doniak and Sunjic, the same paper that Phil Anderson used. And Doniak basically also advocated that the way to isolate the asymmetry is look at the inverse of the spectral peak and plot it as a function of omega minus E star squared, where E star is the location of the peak. So basically, to the left and to the right of the peak, you would get different behaviors. In the model that they had looked at, they had essentially quadratic behavior on one side and very non-quadratic on the other. And this is a way of isolating, you know, asymmetry, looking at it in the right sort of quantitative way. And I would say that a more refined version of this has been put forward in this recent paper of mine, where I say that you should really construct an object which is somewhat convoluted, and I really don't want to give you the full details of that, it'll bore you a little bit, but take the inverse of the spectral function divided by the peak value, blah, 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 compute some object which you can plot as a function of the peak energy. And if you have asymmetry of the type we're talking about, this is going to have a strictly linear term, which is like a smoking gun of a very refined type, you know. And you can get this from even a spectral function which looks allegedly like a very symmetric thing. Actually inverted, you see straight away that it has a linear behavior with the coefficient which is very large. You can actually read some interesting signs into this coefficient B. I may be trying your patience, but I would say just one last thing about the asymmetry is you can take the spectral functions and by force, I mean, nature gave you f of omega times the spectral function because that's what the photo emission gives you. Other people have tried to divide by f of omega, which is a very horrible thing to do because you may be dividing by a very small thing to do, which is a dangerous thing to do. So I would advocate actually multiplying this by f of minus omega. So this, you're not multiplying by anything small, but you're compensating for asymmetry by creating symmetry here. So this isolates the spectral function. Then you can take its symmetric and antisymmetric parts. And here, of course, it's useful to think about a dynamical particle hole transformation, which flips not only omega, but also flips k. And of course, you can put k equal to 0, and that would be like the simpler test of asymmetry. But if you're really macho, if you really have momentum control, this is what you want to do. You want to flip both omega and k, and this particle hole transformation will give you a symmetry factor by taking the ratio of the antisymmetric to the symmetric things, and this can isolate for you the asymmetry factor. And the key thing to note is that this asymmetry distinguishes between various classes of theories. And that's a very important task, you know, at this somewhat late day in cuprate physics, for example. We have so many theories, and none of them has been discarded. How do you explain that? So it's time we sort of rubbed off some theories which don't work. So you need some quantitative test for determining which are wrong, you know. And I think this asymmetry is a very good way to do that. So just to illustrate the asymmetrization procedure, this is the spectral function. Mother Nature multiplies this by f of omega, which is what you see in photo emission. I'm saying be more cruel, multiply this by f of minus omega. So you create some blob here, which is now going to be analyzed. So this guy can be, you take these two quadrants, add and subtract. And if you add them, you get a symmetric version of this bubble. You subtract, you get an antisymmetric version of these two bubbles. Take the ratio, it's a dimensionless number, and that you can actually measure from a fine grid spectral function. And the claim is that there are two classes of theories, one which will have a trivial asymmetry, there'll be no asymmetry whatsoever. There'll be one class of theories which will have asymmetry. So let me say that this is sort of close to being what is achievable. And I would say that ECFL and the Anderson-KC theory have very similar features. Both have asymmetry. And in fact, if I replace my asymmetry energy scale delta 0 by kT, then in fact these two theories become the same. The point is at zero temperature, I would claim that delta 0 is a finite number. So you really have a correction to a Fermi liquid. You have a large correction to a Fermi liquid. Whereas what Phil would say is that this is really kT. So in fact, the scale vanishes at zero temperature. So really the ground state is not a Fermi liquid. It's a non-Fermi liquid at any density. That's what would give you the Anderson-Casey thing. So we can quibble about this distinction. But since all experiments are done at some finite temperature, this may be more of a question of detail, what you can actually extract from data. And both of these guys would give you asymmetry. And I would say it's also important to say that Fermi liquids don't have this kind of large asymmetry. They would give you much more flat things. And some other contenders to explaining cuprate physics, there is this almost anti-ferromagnetic Fermi liquid idea, which goes back to David Pines and his school, and also the marginal Fermi liquid idea, which goes back to Chandra Varma and Elihu and other friends. Both of these guys give you spectral functions which are symmetric in omega. So in other words, you can distinguish between these guys and these guys by doing these experiments. And so we can discriminate between different classes of theories as well. So finally, in a few minutes, I would say that there are some open questions. And there are some results already which are unpublished. I would say superconductivity within the CCFL formalism follows very much an original idea of Anderson, namely exchange J, does give you D-wave superconductivity. That seems to be borne out. And I don't know whether there are other instabilities, and I'm actually bugging Antoine about that. The nature of the Mott insulating state, I think, is a very interesting problem. We really should be able to write down a propagator for the Mott state, because Mott state, although it's an insulator, it's not an insulator in both directions. You can take out a particle and that will propagate in some incoherent way. And how do we understand that? Can we probe that? These are interesting questions remaining here. Underdoped phases, other broken symmetries, and these are various things that we can do. Thank you very much.